For the week of February 6th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 91, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gilts.
You're back in New York from Cairo.
I'm back in New York from Cairo, and you're back in Los Angeles from Ireland?
From Dublin, yes.
From Dublin. Ah, good trip. Successful, productive.
Very productive, very successful. I even went to the Guinness factory, and I now know how Guinness beer is made.
And they had free samples at the end, I imagine.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm walking through the entire museum, and I'm saying to myself, where is everyone? You'd think this would be packed. It says on the brochure that it's the most visited attraction in all of Ireland. And then you get to the Sky Bar, I think it's the Sky Bar, Galaxy Bar up at the top. And sure enough, that's where everybody is.
They don't even bother with the tour. They just go to the bar and start drinking.
I guess so. Here I was being educated on the way Guinness beer is made, but everybody else decided that they would educate themselves through actually drinking it.
Guinness is my beer of choice. I like a beer you can chew.
Yes, I used a knife and fork to cut mine.
And how are you feeling? I know you came back and your whole family is under the weather.
Yes, I'm jet-lagged and sick, but that does not stop us from bringing you all of the week's top entertainment news. And in fact, you know, Michael, in broadcasting, there's something known as a cold opening or a cold open. I'm going to practice today the Stephen Colbert open. So On today's show, Michael Moore bites the hand that feeds him by suing his distributors, the Weinstein Brothers. But will it make him sicko? The Grammys are on Sunday, but does anyone really care? The White Stripes and LCD Sound System certainly don't. Both bands are calling it quits. Because we're American citizens, we have to talk about the Super Bowl, but let's face it, we really only cared about the commercials. Critics take their first look at the $65 million musical Spider-Man and were surprised at just how awful the show really is. Of course, we always cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, Super Bowl weekend is always a poor weekend at the box office, or usually, and this weekend was no exception. The number one film of the week was The Roommate from Screen Gems, which grossed $15 million for a movie so bad they didn't want to show it to critics or, frankly, even fans. Number two is Sanctum, which made $9.4 million. This is the 3D spelunking movie. One is a James Cameron film, not a James Cameron film, when it's only presented by James Cameron. And no matter how many times you announce that in the ads, people aren't tricked into thinking it's actually a good movie. And number three is No Strings Attached, which grossed another $8 million and is at $51 million total. It's the year of her life for Natalie Portman. And number four is The King's Speech, the Oscar frontrunner, which grossed another $7.7 million and is at $83 million total in the U.S. and another $86 million overseas. At number five is The Green Hornet, which grossed $6 million. It's at $87 million total and another $83 million overseas. At number six is The Rite, the god-awful Anthony Hopkins movie about exorcism, which grossed $5.5 million. At number seven is the Jason Statham action film The Mechanic at $5.2 million. At number eight is the Coen Brothers film True Grit, which is now at $154 million total in the U.S., making it the second highest grossing Western of all time behind Dances with Wolves. At nine is Black Swan, which is at $95 million and about to pass $100 million. Amazing. And number 10 is The Dilemma, which grossed $3.2 million and is fading fast and has $45 million total.
Wow. Well, you did mention that Super Bowl Sunday here in the United States is often a very poorly attended box office weekend, but this Super Bowl weekend was the worst attended in over 16 years.
Meaning ticket sales or grosses?
Ticket sales. I mean, well, even grosses. I mean, Dear John led the weekend during the same weekend last year, and it made $30 million in the top spot, and The Roommate made 15.
Well, we won't be surprised because, of course, as we'll discuss later, the Super Bowl was the highest rated Super Bowl of all time, the highest rated TV broadcast of a single show in America in history. So
yes.
It's not surprising that the box office would take a hit. Overseas, though, things are going pretty well.
Yes, indeed. I mean, The King's Speech is already up to $86.8 million.
Mm-hmm.
Green Hornet, which was a complete debacle here in the United States and North America, has made $83.8 million.
Well, I'd say Green Hornet isn't so much a debacle as sort of a close shave. They can all heave a sigh of relief and say, okay, we're not going to lose our shirt on this movie. They were hoping for a franchise. I doubt they'll make a second film. Grossing $160 million worldwide and counting just means that it won't be a disaster. A real disaster in the U.S. was Gulliver's Travels, the Jack Black film, which cost over $100 million to make and grossed only $41 million. That was a disaster. But overseas, it's more than tripled that gross, and it looks like it might quadruple it. It's at $140 million overseas, $100 million more than it made in the U.S. So that's a huge overseas success, which, again, doesn't make the film a hit, but saves them from feeling like they're going to lose their shirt.
Well, yeah, if it wasn't for international Chronicles of Narnia, Little Fockers, Tron Legacy, Yogi Bear, all these movies would have been seen as disappointments.
Well, I think they're all most of them are still disappointments. Tron Legacy is at $372 million worldwide. Again, that might be enough for them to pull the trigger on a sequel. You don't know, but it's not a disaster. It's not great. Little Fockers has equaled the worldwide gross of the original. Meet the Parents made $300 million. Little Fockers made $303 million. They're virtually tied. But Meet the Fockers, the middle movie in that genre, made $500 million. And that's, you know, an extra $200 million. So they have to be disappointed. Chronicles of Narnia is on a long downward slope. It's nowhere near the first, which was nowhere, you know. The first was $748 million. The second Narnia made $400 million. The third one's at $376 million. The movies are costing more money to make and making less money at the box office.
So you're saying it's trending in the wrong direction.
To say the least. Whereas Harry Potter is just almost flatlined. It's been very, very consistent. There have been little upticks and downtips, but $700-$900 million is what they've made film after film after film. And Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 is no exception. It is now, however, the highest grossing Harry Potter film since the first one. So the original
Harry Potter.
But the
first Harry one, Potter, I mean, think about it. The first one was released when? In 2001, 2002, somewhere in there?
Mm-hmm.
And it made, what, like $950, $975 million?
Exactly.
And ticket prices have since risen, and yet this film, The Deathly Hallows, has made about $950 million.
That's to paint that as some sort of disappointment is crazy.
I'm not painting it as a disappointment. What I'm saying is that less people must be going, given that ticket prices have gone up.
It's this fifth, sixth sequel in a series. It would be bizarre if less. What's notable is how many people continue to go, not the fact that less people went. I mean, it's 2001 to 2010. The difference in prices is not that dramatic. But I mean, prices haven't doubled or anything in the decade.
No, I don't believe so.
I mean, this is an incredibly consistent series, which is very rare in movie history. One, two, three, four, five. I'm sorry. This is the seventh film in a series, and it's still grossing as much as the blockbuster first one, which is one of the highest grossing movies of all time.
How did you need to count for that? Didn't you call it HP17B?
HP7P1. That's right. But I got confused about when they split the last film. I wanted to make sure I wasn't miscounting. Yes, if you go back decades and generations, keeping in mind inflation and ticket price increases and all that is important. But, you know, they've both been released in the same decade. It's not that big a difference.
But, you know, speaking of miscounting, our first story here in movies is about Michael Moore, who is saying that the Weinstein brothers, Harvey and Bob, miscounted the profits on Fahrenheit 9/11.
Well, I'm not surprised because it made so much more money than anyone could ever have expected.
I think it made, what, over $100 million, right? This was a documentary back in 2004, won the Cannes Film Festival in 2004, won the Palme d'Or, and it was about George W. Bush and his administration.
That's right, and it grossed $100 million in the U.S. That's a stunning amount of money, the most money in a theatrical release. There have been
for a documentary.
Right. Well, there have been documentaries that played in museums for like 20 years that grossed more. But for a theatrical release of a documentary, it was far and away the biggest grossing of all time.
Right. And on Monday here in Los Angeles, Michael Moore went out and sued Bob and Harvey Weinstein, who formed a special company, Fellowship Adventure Group, just to distribute Fahrenheit 9/11 after Disney said, "We're not touching it." And they distributed it through Lionsgate and IFC Films on their own. And Michael Moore is claiming that the brothers defrauded him of at least $2.7 million in profits that they owe him. Now, they've already paid him something like $19.8 million.
Well, it's made $222 million worldwide, and he's the only person who would have any slice of the pie. So I'm not surprised he'd make that much money. It was a stunningly successful hit. And, of course, the Weinsteins have Burt Fields, one of the most famous lawyers in Hollywood, defending them. And they say he's been paid everything he was due and is just trying to make a public spectacle. And Burt Fields called it a, quote, routine kind of auditing and said, "Mr. Moore has put in a number of very inflammatory claims designed for the press. He should be ashamed of himself."
Well, I mean, I think Burt Fields is paid to say things like that.
That's right. And he claims he's still owed about $2.7 million from the movie. But where did you get the figure that he's already made $20 million from it? Is that from the same article?
I believe it was from The Hollywood Reporter, not from The New York Times, which is where we're quoting some of these figures.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, auditing and net profits and gross profits and all that sort of stuff is a never-ending source of contention. That's why, you know, you never want to bother with net points. You always want to deal with, you know, grosses.
Yes, although studios are loath to give them up these days.
Well, with grosses, they can't hide grosses.
Right. No, what I'm saying is they're loath to give up the gross points.
They don't of course.
Now, I guess we should move on over into music. And this Sunday, the Grammys are taking place, and they're going to award the best in music. But do you care, Michael?
I do care. I always care. I watch the Grammys for the live performances. But, you know, in a week where we've seen the Super Bowl set records and sports in general do so tremendously well in prime time, it'll be interesting to see, with music sales so far down, whether anybody will tune in. I'm not sure if audiences care that much.
Well, I think it's really, I mean, what, it's going to be on a Sunday night. What else is on? Football's over, so it doesn't have football to compete with.
It's the February sweeps. This is the period when networks typically present their biggest shows. They have special episodes of their regular series, weddings, babies are born, romances blossom, specials and TV movies. This is when it all happens.
So now, you're not talking in real life that babies are born. You mean on the storylines of these shows.
That's right. But yes, yeah, this is supposed to be the most competitive times of the year. February sweeps and May sweeps and in fall. I mean, this is when November sweeps. This is when it's supposed to be bigger than ever. So there's lots of things on television on Sunday.
Okay. Well, I'm going to watch the Grammys.
All right.
Mainly because we have to talk about it the very next day. Or actually, we're recording on Tuesday next week, so it'll be on Tuesday that we have to talk about it. But still, we need to know what happened.
Right, and one of the saddest news is that the White Stripes are breaking up. I wish they were performing at the Grammys so we'd get one last look at them. I'm really kind of devastated because they've been one of the best acts of the past decade.
Yeah, and I've seen them perform a couple times, at least once at Coachella and twice at their own shows. For those who don't know, the band, the White Stripes, consisted of they're not really brother and sister, Jack and Meg White. They were actually officially married at one point, and Jack took Meg's last name. And they haven't released an album in about 4 years. And on Wednesday last, they formally announced on their website that they are ending the band. They're breaking up.
Officially married? What a strange way of...
Well, they were officially married.
Yeah. Officially, though.
As opposed to unofficially brother and sister.
Oh, yeah, no, that was part of their playfulness as far as
right.
Who they were. Yeah, I guess their last proper studio album was Icky Thump in 2007.
Right.
I mean, they've had live albums and DVDs and things like that since then. But they've had six proper studio albums, and two or three or four of them are just, you know,
classics.
Classics, yeah. And of course, Jack White is a big fixture in music. He's got two other bands going, but I'm really bummed.
Yeah, apparently at Coachella last year, I did not go see The Dead Weather, which is one of his bands, and apparently it was one of the best sets at last year's Coachella. And I did see the Raconteurs perform the year before. I'm not a really big fan of the Raconteurs, to be frank. I'm not. I don't really care.
I liked their second album a lot better than their first.
Yes, that is true. And you know, he does have a record company, Jack White, called Third Man. He just produced Wanda Jackson's latest album. She's the 73-year-old queen of rockabilly. And it's getting rave reviews.
It's getting good reviews. I remember back in college when she had an album coming out and was being rediscovered even back then in the 80s. So, you know, she's been around so long, she's had a couple rebirths. But I've seen them perform on TV. It's a lot of fun, sort of similar to what he did with Loretta Lynn. He's obviously going to be very active. It'll be interesting to see if Meg White does a solo album or tours with other people. Or I mean, I have no reason to think she wouldn't stay in music, but you just don't know what was the driving force for her because she doesn't give many interviews. And obviously, she hasn't done all the massive side projects that he's done. So I'm not sure what will happen with her.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that, look, it's not due to artistic differences or lack of wanting to continue, nor any health issues, as both Meg and Jack are feeling fine and in good health, the two said in their statement. It's for a myriad of reasons, but mostly to preserve what is beautiful and special about the band and have it stay that way. Now, okay, so it's not health, it's not artistic. I mean, so it's...
They've just done everything. They feel like they've done everything they can with the group. I mean, it wasn't... their choice in a way, but for the Beatles, it's the same thing. You know, they were together for 7 years as far as studio albums, you know, 63 to 70, and then they were done. And that's one of the things that makes them so special, that, in, you know, the greatest music of all time. But unlike, say, the Rolling Stones, they don't keep trudging out every year with a new album. You know, that wasn't what they did through the 70s and 80s. So it kept that period of incredible creativity special.
Well, you know, I have to say that there was always a rumor that Meg White really learned how to play the drums to be in that band, and that she really wasn't a drummer. She just happened to be, you know, somebody that Jack White wanted to work with.
Oh, she was his wife.
Well, yes.
Yeah, but she's a terrific drummer. She's got a great sense of Ringo-like sense of timing. You know, she's a serious artist.
Yeah, in the middle of their tour for Icky Thump, they kind of canceled the rest of the tour because she had a bout with anxiety.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, and so that's why they kind of mentioned that it's not a health issue. It's not that she doesn't want to go on tour again. But I think that, I have to say, every time I watch them perform, he is such a control freak that she would, you know, crash a cymbal and he'd grab it to stop it from crashing. You know, like, in other words, he even had to control her instrument.
No, I've never seen them, so I didn't know that. And in contrast, I could care less that LCD Sound System is calling it a day.
Well, yeah, okay, so now here's another group that's kind of like a disco, poppy, electronica band, and they are amazing live. I saw them at Coachella last year, and they just tore the place down. And it started by a guy whose name is now completely escaping me, but they're going to perform their last show April 2nd.
All right, so another act says goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, it was started by a guy who is kind of like a music geek, and he just kind of started it on a whim, and now I blew up.
James Murphy is who
you're trying. Thank you. Yes, I could not, for some reason, it just, his name completely escaped me. And he doesn't have a great voice, but he's kind of, and nor all that, I mean, he's not Justin Bieber. He's not, a good-looking Johnny Depp-like guy, but he kind of has a bit of a stage presence, and the music is infective. It's kind of sad to see that they're going away.
Well, I mean, they barely arrived and they're already going away. They have one of the most acclaimed albums of the year. It's been on a lot of best of the year lists, and I'll be finishing up my best of the year list before the Sunday Night Grammys, and I'll be posting it on Huffington Post. So I've got to get that done by Friday or Saturday or maybe even Sunday.
So you're going to be finishing it up before 2012?
No. It always takes me into January and early February. I always make the Grammys my deadline for my music and the Oscars the deadline for my movies. Because there's a lot of great music out there. Really is. Sales are way down, but there's a lot of great music. Did you watch the Super Bowl? I know you were traveling. Did you actually catch it? Were you one of the 111 million Americans who watched the Super Bowl?
I was, but I was probably counted through my TiVo because I was landing as the Super Bowl started and I had to go through customs at LAX. And let me tell you, you have never seen customs officials move so slowly in your life.
You think they were dragging their feet because it was Super Bowl Sunday? Really?
No, I don't. But I think that they were just dragging their feet in general. And it was just funny that, like, on Super Bowl Sunday, they were just kind of like, next, please.
Well, football was on a tear and has been on a tear for weeks now. The postseason games were hitting 15-year highs in total viewership. One of the games appearing on NBC's Sunday Night Football program was the number one show for the week. And that doesn't sound that amazing or stunning. I mean, you know, football obviously can draw a lot of people. But in fact, for a regularly scheduled weekly sports show in prime time, you know, like Sunday Night Football, Monday Night Football, or back in the day, they used to have boxing and basketball and baseball in prime time. Throughout all of television history, for the past 60 years, this is the very first time a regularly scheduled sports program hit number one in the ratings. Obviously, that doesn't include the postseason. It doesn't include, you know, the World Series, the Super Bowl, the Olympics, and special events like that. But just like we've got a show on our schedule, we got boxing on Tuesdays, we've got, you know, football on Monday, we've got baseball on Thursday. Whatever it was, for the past 60 years, this is the very first time in one of those sports shows ranked number one for the week. So with all that going on and the Packers and the Steelers having, you know, really good Super Bowl history and a good fan base, you just knew this year was primed for big ratings.
Well, and also all of the other television networks not putting anything on up against the Super Bowl, because who wants to counter-program that? You know, this was really the only thing to watch last Sunday evening, that is. This is why all of the networks are fighting over live television.
That's right. This is where the money is. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Grammys. I think the Oscars will do well because people have seen the movies. The Super Bowl does well because people watch football every week. The Grammys, people aren't buying albums, and I don't think they're engaged with music. So it's not clear to me that people will actually care about the Grammys. But by and large, live events are where it's at for them, and they want to be, you know, in the mix.
Yes, well, and in the mix this year were not only great plays by Aaron Rodgers and Ben Roethlisberger for the Green Bay Packers and the Pittsburgh Steelers.
But I can see you're a big football fan.
I'm trying to get to the commercials, which is what we really care about.
Before the commercials began, we had two pregame performances, Lea Michele from Glee and Christina Aguilera. Lea Michele sang, not God Bless America, she sang America the Beautiful, I think. And Christina Aguilera sang the national anthem, famously messing up the lyrics. She repeated one stanza twice rather than singing the proper lyrics. Both were not great.
No, and I thought, why put Lea Michele up there? And then I realized, oh, because the Super Bowl is on Fox, the same network that airs Glee.
Well, and they're airing Glee after the show, and Glee is the hottest show in television.
Yeah, okay, true. I just like being cynical.
And they're the best-selling act, practically, of the last 2 years, you know, right up there with Taylor Swift, and she sings, so and she's a Broadway star, so it makes perfect sense. Christina Aguilera, however, was pretty bad, and the only thing I'll say in their favor is that they were both singing live. For a lot of years now, people are just lip-syncing to pre-recorded tracks. They were both clearly singing live, especially with Christina. Obviously, she would have had the right lyrics if it was pre-recorded.
Yes, that's true.
And then we moved on to the commercials. What were your favorite commercials, or what were your worst?
Well, the worst, I thought, I mean, there were so many bad ones this year. Really, all the movie ads were bad. I didn't think there were that many good movie ads.
No, they were very bad. I mean, Captain America and what was the other one? Thor. They just sort of blended together. Big, muscly, blonde guys. I mean, I couldn't even tell what was going on or anything about them. I got no sense of them at all.
Yeah, and I didn't think the GoDaddy ads were that good. The best commercial for me was probably the Darth Vader commercial, where it was for the Passat, Volkswagen Passat, where this little kid wearing a Darth Vader outfit, including the helmet, this big, giant helmet, was like trying to use the Force to levitate dogs and levitate his, you know, clean up his room, and then he goes outside to his car and to his father's car and tries to turn the car on, and all of a sudden it turns on. But it was really his father inside, you know, the house with the key.
Well, it was cute, but it's one of those ads where I don't remember what the ad was for. I mean, it was for a car, but it came so briefly at the end that and it doesn't really have anything to do with a car and the fact that you have a remote control to open the door like every car does. So to me, it's a clever piece of entertainment, but not a good ad as far as selling the product, because I didn't remember it at all.
Well, so actually, I would have to say the worst ads, Groupon, which is this social networking, you know, discount site.
That's right. I have a friend who works for them. So I'm very bummed that I didn't like the ad either. They had this sort of faux mock social, what's the word I want? A mockumentary of a socially conscious ad. It started off saying Tibet. Tibet's culture is under attack, and Tibet needs your help, and Tibet is under the threat of, you know, disappearing forever. And then we cut to Timothy Hutton in a restaurant, and he said, "But they still make a wicked, you know, pad thai." And I got
30% off thanks to Groupon.
Yeah. Right. And so they had a series of ads making fun of socially conscious things like Tibet or Save the Whales or things like that. And then jokingly switched to Groupon, and it was a confusing ad. It was a dumb ad. It was flippant. I mean, we all got that it was supposed to be a joke. It was just weird. I wasn't offended. It just didn't work. And of course, now they were directed by Christopher Guest, the director of This Is Spinal Tap. Not the director, but one of the stars.
And Waiting for Guffman.
Waiting for Guffman and a string of very famous mockumentaries. Groupon is now very defensive and saying, "It was a joke. It was a joke. We're going to donate money to all those charities. We'll match funds to what other people send in, up to $100,000. They've got like four different charities. But I think it was a disaster.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, I guess a lot was made out of the two ads that Eminem appeared in, including one for Chrysler, which was more about Detroit than Chrysler.
I really liked the – I was stunned by that. A, that he was in an ad. He'd never done any commercials before as far as I know. If he had, I don't remember them. The first one was an animated claymation one for Lipton Brisk Iced Tea. And it was all about Eminem saying, "I don't do ads. People want me to be in ads all the time. I'm not going to be in an ad. It's ridiculous. And usually when they hand me the product, I go, it's really lame." And then he took a sip of the brisk and he said, "But damn, that's pretty good." And I thought it was really fun. And it was just so unusual to see him doing an ad. And then he was in a second ad, and it was basically celebrating Detroit and the city and saying, we know how to make great cars. You know, this is Detroit. This is what we do. And it was very serious. And there was like a gospel choir up on stage when he's walking into this big theater. And I thought both ads were really interesting.
It was like very Michael Bay-esque.
Michael Bay.
Well, you know, that like Americana kind of, you know, those great shots, those commercial slow-mo shots of American icons and iconic images.
Yeah, of Detroit specifically. But I thought they were really interesting. I thought it was fat. I thought, you know, the reason he did the Chrysler one was because it really did celebrate Detroit. It wasn't just pushing Chrysler. He wasn't going, man, Chrysler's the bomb. He was saying, you know, Detroit is a great city. And, you know, Detroit is really on its knees. It really needs help. And so I thought that might have been why he was drawn to that ad. But, of course, then he did the other ad for Lipton Brisk Teas. So who knows what's going on? I think he realizes to stay in the public eye. I mean, he had the best-selling or one of the two best-selling albums last year. You know, he had a very good-selling album, relatively speaking. But maybe he realizes to stay in the public eye, you know, ads are a great way to do it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, ads are one way not only to stay in the public eye, but with decreasing album sales, one way to make money, which is why it's so weird that LCD Sound System and the White Stripes would, you know, stop performing and stop recording because, you know, the recordings aren't making them any money. Only appearing live makes them any money these days. So why break up? That's, well, I guess maybe they'll go on to do other things. But anyway.
There was another ad that I thought was the worst was a car ad. I'm not even sure for what car. Was it the Passat as well? It was a car ad with a fake game show called Cram It in the Boot. And it's all about trying to fit as much stuff as you could in the trunk, in the back space of the car. But of course, the way they did it, it was all an allusion to anal sex. They were selling a car with an allusion, an elaborate metaphor of anal sex during the Super Bowl.
Are we allowed to say that on this show?
I think so, but it was unbelievable. It was sort of jaw-dropping. But it wasn't in a raunchy, hilarious, oh my God, I can't believe they did that. It was more in a, what the heck were they thinking sort of reaction.
Actually, another great commercial was the beaver commercial for Bridgestone tires, where, you know, the guy swerves to avoid the beaver in the road on his Bridgestone tires, and then later on the beaver knocks down a tree to prevent the guy from going over a bridge that's out.
Again, it was a cute story, but, you know, it wasn't until the last second you saw Bridgestone tires and knew that it was for tires rather than beavers.
Yeah, but think about it. Bridgestone tires sponsored the halftime show, and you only saw their names at the beginning and end of the halftime show.
I thought the Justin Bieber ad was a disaster.
What was that even about?
These people, I think in general for the ads, we can say that they're all so overhyped and over aggressive in trying to make a big, huge, splashy, elaborate concept-y ad that they forget to sell the product, A, and B, that they're just so far up their butt that they can't make a good one to save their lives. I would say 95% of them were pretty awful.
Disastrous. Yes, I would agree.
Yeah.
What did
you think of the halftime show?
You know, as you know, I'm a huge fan of the Black Eyed Peas. Huge. Love them. Worship the ground they walk on. This is where you tell me that I'm actually not a big fan of the Black Eyed Peas. Yeah. No, I'm not a big fan of the Black Eyed Peas. And I know they're getting a lot of flack for that performance. And they didn't sound very good. But I have to say that the spectacle of that halftime show was unreal. I mean, I really thought it was 12 minutes, 33 seconds, and it never stopped. They incorporated the entire field with all of these dancers that had glow suits on that glowed different colors during different parts of the show. And they had Slash from Guns N' Roses show up with his guitar and Usher jumping around doing splits. And the light show extended all the way up through all the levels of the stadium. I mean, they really put on a huge show.
Well, I agree about the spectacle, the visual side of it. I thought it was fun how they had the whole field filled with dancers and they were dancing in unison and doing all sorts of elaborate things, sort of an Olympic type moment. And I thought that visual side came across well, though they looked silly on stage in their space age suits. But they sounded terrible.
Yes, they did.
It is a musical performance. They sounded terrible, and they have so few big songs. It was sort of embarrassing. I mean, in the middle, they're doing a cover of Sweet Child of Mine and bringing in Slash. You know, that's how thin of a catalog they have. And then they sang I've Had the Time of My Life.
Which is on one of their albums. That's on one of their albums, I thought.
I looked for it. I didn't find it on one of their albums. It's still sad. I don't care if it's on one of their albums. It's still sad that a cover of an old hit that they didn't have a big hit with would be a number. It felt very, very thin and lame. And as a musical performance, I thought it was god-awful.
Oh, and, you know, you're kind of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You know, you put somebody
No, you put on a good performance, you're not damned.
No. What I mean is the Super Bowl is kind of, you know, they're damned if they put somebody on like Janet Jackson and she does something edgy. They're damned if they put on The Who.
She didn't do anything edgy. She exposed her breast.
Well, the FCC thought that was edgy. You put on a classic rock act like Tom Petty and everybody thinks you're lame. And then you put on the Black Eyed Peas, which I mean, that had to cost millions of dollars, that halftime show. And then you're blamed because the band isn't that good. Well, yeah. Have you seen most pop acts lately? They're not that good.
No, there are plenty of great acts, classic and new, that you could put on that would do a better job than the Black Eyed Peas did. They made a bad choice. The bands would have been a better choice a year ago because their album was much hotter.
Yeah,
though
true.
They still would have been lame live, but at least they would have been, you know, in the moment. Their time has already passed. Their new album is a complete disaster. So they just look lame and trying to look current.
You know, actually, I'm thinking about it now. I think the best ad I saw during the Super Bowl came during Glee. That ad that they kind of had this old Busby Berkeley.
I liked the Glee ad a lot, too. I thought it was very clever, very fun.
It was for Chevy. And yeah. I know that because they kept saying the name Chevy in their little dance routine and song act.
Yeah, no, I thought it was good. And if we're going to go on to talk about Glee, I did think their ad was very clever, had a nice retro feel to it, but it played to the strengths of the show and who they were. So it didn't have them doing something weird and different, that might appeal to parents or grandparents. And I thought it was good. But the show itself, rather bizarrely, they were plugging the Glee episode, of course, during the game. But I never had the sense that it was a football-themed episode. I didn't really get that big of a... You know, I watched every ad, and I had no idea that the Glee episode was going to be such a football. It was all about high school football. They clearly went nine yards to make a show that would appeal to fans of the Super Bowl. It was all centered on a football game, but they didn't let you know that.
Well, football's 100 yards long, so if it only went 9 yards,
they went the full 9 yards.
The whole 9 yards. Okay, yeah.
But they didn't make it clear. You know, they went to all that trouble, and they didn't tell people. By the way, the Glee episode we're going to show is all about football. It was a dreadful, dreadful episode. It was stupid. It was dumb. It was moronic. It was the worst episode of Glee I think I've ever seen. None of the songs had anything to do with the show or the performance or the characters. They were just random tunes. You know, they had a halftime show at the football game and performed Thriller. And they had a lame reason for doing it, but it didn't matter. They did a cover of a old Destiny's Child song, Bills, Bills, Bills. Had nothing to do with the characters or the moment. So it was just bad on every level and a huge wasted opportunity. It's the highest rated episode of Glee ever, obviously. But it did like 14 million viewers less than the show that played after the Super Bowl last year, which was Undercover Boss, that reality series.
Is that still on? Yeah, I guess it is still on.
It's doing quite well, actually. Yeah, Undercover Boss did very well. And they also had a number of ads in the second half for The X Factor. They had a lot of ads for American Idol, and they played up the happiness and the joyfulness and the American Idol. It's all fun and good. You know, they got away from the negativity and more about celebration of music. And then in the second half, suddenly they had an ad or two for The X Factor, for the Simon Cowell show. That doesn't start till the fall. I'm sure they wanted to keep their main property, American Idol, happy and not feel that they were one-upped. But suddenly they had two or three ads for The X Factor and said, he's back, and had gigantic, you know.
Did he ever go away, really? I mean...
version of Simon Cowell. And then the next day they announced that they'd have a $5 million recording contract for the winner. So, you know, they're just starting to gear up for that. I mean, American Idol's the number one show in the country, but X Factor is definitely coming in the fall.
Speaking of things that are coming, in our theater news, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark doesn't officially open, of course, until March 15th, if it opens on March 15th. Apparently, most of the major New York outlets got together and decided enough was enough and that they'd all treat the most recent planned opening of February 7th as the real opening. And what's the verdict? Well, it's not so good. In fact, disastrous. Ben Brantley of the New York Times. Well, Michael, what did Ben Brantley of the New York Times say?
Well, he described how the show was just trudging along, and then suddenly there was a technical glitch, an error, right in a scene where the Green Goblin and Spider-Man are facing off, and the show ground to a halt, and, you know, things stopped, and actors were dangling in the air or whatever. And he said... And that was when the first moment of actual pleasure coursed through the audience. People were so excited and glad. Ooh, it's going wrong, just like they'd always read about in the papers. And he said they were actually pleased that something had gone wrong.
It's like going to a NASCAR event. They're waiting for the car crash.
Right, or they get to go home and say, yeah, I went to Spider-Man and it stopped and they had a technical problem. And he said they should sell T-shirts in the lobby that say, I saw Spider-Man and lived. You know, he said they should play it up, that, you know, the idea that something could go wrong. But when it came to his money quote, he said, this is unbelievable, Spider-Man is not only the most expensive musical ever to hit Broadway, it may also rank among the worst.
Yes, that's – I'm like, are you going to put that one on the poster? Because that one, I think, deserves to go on the poster. It's a very memorable line, as is. You know, he said if you're not going to sell those I Saw Spider-Man and Live T-shirts, then a more appropriate slogan might be I Saw Spider-Man and Slept.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how this happened because – they must have spoken to each other. The Times and the Daily News and the Hollywood Reporter and Variety. Everybody.
And the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, they all posted their reviews yesterday. So they must have been in contact with each other.
Who knows? I mean, you know, the New York Times called Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark a teetering colossus that can't find its bearings as a circus spectacle or as a rock musical. And that the battle over healthcare reform has a better shot at being resolved before the manifold problems of this frenetic Broadway jumble get fixed. And that's Charles McNulty of the Los Angeles Times writing.
Yeah, and that's very typical. The reviews were disastrous. Now it'll be interesting to see if this affects the box office.
Yeah, I mean, I think Charles McNulty said it's not going to affect anything. They're still going to, you know, only a nuclear explosion could affect people not going to see this show.
Well, you know, that's not true because we've had shows like The Little Mermaid and Tarzan, not to pick on Disney, but they just spring to mind, or Shrek, which run for a year or a year and a half or two on Broadway, but basically lose money. And then the question is whether their name brand is strong enough that they can make it back on the road. I think with these reviews being so bad, their plan to really make their money on the road in big stadiums is very much, you know, in danger now. You know, will word of mouth be good? I can't imagine. When you look on the message boards for Broadway shows, nobody likes it. It's not like fans are liking it and, you know, the theater critics hate it. There are some shows like Wicked, which won a lot of Tonys, but basically did not get good reviews. But people love it.
Yes, you know, and it's a good show.
The Addams Family got terrible reviews, but people have really been going to it. Whether they'll keep going when Nathan Lane is gone, that's a question mark. But they absolutely have gone to the show and clearly it must be getting some good word of mouth or would have closed already. Nathan Lane is a big draw. But it's been doing a million plus at the box office. So, you know, theater reviews matter. And as a case in point, to show that the papers still have a little pull, the New York Times ran a rave review for Three Sisters, the Chekhov play, which is playing off-Broadway, with a pretty starry cast, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Peter Sarsgaard, Josh Hamilton. And, you know, that's already going to be a pretty popular ticket with those people in it. But when the Times review ran, which was an absolute rave, the show sold out its entire run in 24 hours.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, so they can still, you know, it's a small off-Broadway house, but the Times can still, you know, help a show a lot with a very positive review.
You know what else is pretty good?
What?
$315 million.
I've gotten more emails and phone calls and questions about this. Tell them.
Well, okay. And the reason, Michael, you're getting all of those phone calls and emails is they want to know how much money you received when AOL purchased the Huffington Post, because, of course, some of your work appears there every week. And they purchased the Huffington Post for $315 million. And I guess you said here, 1 + 1 = 11, says AOL CEO Tim Armstrong. And so AOL is going away from being an internet service provider, an ISP, and they are becoming a content provider instead. Content is king, and AOL is doubling down.
Well, you know, and what's fascinating is how many of much of AOL's revenue comes from people who are paying monthly bills for dial-up service they don't even know they're still paying for. I mean, there's a big scandal as far as a lot of their revenue is from people who just don't realize that their monthly credit card is being charged.
Right. 60% of their revenue.
That's unbelievable. So they really need to get going. But I mean, the articles about this, I mean, it sounds like they went on their first date. Ariana said that they were finishing each other's sentences right away.
Yes. You know? I watched them on the Piers Morgan CNN show last night. And I was just like, oh, yeah, these two together. You know what? I'll tell you, AOL has had a long history in content. They own Cinematical. They bought Weblogs, I think, back in 2005, 2006, somewhere in there. And Cinematical, I believe, Lifehacker. You know what? I probably shouldn't say exactly. Engadget, I know, is in there. So they do have experience with content.
Well, they were once like the main portal for content, weren't they?
Well, yes, but that was 1994.
Right, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, I'm saying that they you know, and it wasn't it a week ago AOL said that they were going to be the venue for women? Women were going to turn to AOL for everything they needed. Now suddenly they're, well, now everyone's going to turn to us.
Right, because Ariana Huffington is here.
Right, and she's going to be in charge of all their news media, not just Huffington Post, but all the news media. Some people say, well, won't it be too liberal now? They won't be seen as, you know, objective. And she says, oh, please, we got to get beyond liberal and conservative.
Well, you know what's interesting is, you know, they bought TechCrunch, AOL, that is. Mike Arrington, who runs TechCrunch, I wonder if what he feels about reporting to Arianna Huffington. I mean, he's got a huge ego. And so, it'll be interesting because they put her in charge of all content on AOL.
He was already reporting to someone. If they own it, he was already reporting to someone. So, you know.
Right, but he was still the editor of his own content. Now she's the editor-in-chief of all AOL content, which includes TechCrunch and Edgadget.
He had a boss already. He wasn't in charge.
Oh, so you're saying it's not a big deal that, you know, he now has to report to Huffington.
No, I don't think it is. And I can see where you're going with that. But I will say, I mean, I got phone people calling me, emailing me, texting me. Are you going to make money now? Are they going to pay you now for your stories on Huffington Post? You know, you got to remember, Huffington Post has like tens of thousands of contributors. And there is no business model in which they ever plan to pay those people for voluntarily posting stuff on Huffington Post. You want to do that? Go right ahead. You don't want to? That's fine. They'll survive without you. But, you know, they're not going to suddenly have a staff of 20,000 people who are getting paid every week. So no, they're not sending me checks now for my work on Huffington Post.
But don't you think a lot of people feel like, you know what, why exactly is she being paid $350? She basically built her business on the backs of others who she did not pay.
No, she didn't. We've gone through this before. She did not say, how can I screw over 10,000 people and make money off of it? She said, I want to set up a competitor to Drudge Report. She came up with a very smart liberal competitor to Drudge Report, got a lot of traffic, and then said, hey, you want to post, you know, I've got all these people coming to my site to look for links to headline stories, which is still 2/3 of the website every day, links to stories in other media. She said, hey, you want to put something on there, Barbara Streisand, put something on there, Bill Maher. She went to her friends and said, hey, if you want to post something, don't just put it on your own website, put it on mine, or put half of it on mine and link to yours. More people will see it. And they started to say, okay. And then they said, well, why not make here? Journalists would come and say, do you mind if I post this on there? She's like, sure, go right ahead. You know, great. You know, brings more traffic to my site, brings more traffic to your site. Everybody benefits. And it happened very naturally and organically that it became the most popular, one of the most popular news sites in the world. And linked to a lot of newspaper articles and other media, and also had people suddenly say, you know what, they've got 10 million people and they're letting me post something up for free, brings me attention and credibility, why not? If the New York Times told me I could post something on their entertainment page, guess what? I do it. They've got traffic. If I'm going to put something on my own website, why not also put it on Huffington Post and reach a potential of 20 million people as opposed to the 4 who come to my website? So it was no grand scheme to screw over people. It was just an opening up of the site to say, hey, if you want to, put something on there. Go right ahead.
Well, I mean, we could do a whole show on this, but we should probably move on since we're running long on time here to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story is about news. In fact, when a crisis strikes, people turn to the 24-hour news channels. That used to mean CNN would be back on top, even if Fox News scored higher day in and day out due to its popular talk shows. Not anymore. During the Egyptian crisis, people watching cable news are turning to Fox. It's scoring more than CNN and MSNBC combined, both in total viewers and the advertiser-friendly 25 to 54 demographic. That includes primetime and all-day coverage. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I don't think this is necessarily the first news crisis where this has happened, but it just solidifies Fox leadership. I mean, they are number one in every possible way, even in breaking news, which used to be the final refuge that CNN had.
A new number one album on the Billboard charts and a new record low. That's the story on Amos Lee's new CD, Mission Bell. It debuted at number one on the Billboard Top 200 chart with first week sales of 40,478 copies. The smallest amount ever for a number one album. It's the third time that's happened this year. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Because it's certainly not big sales.
Well, it's becoming so commonplace, it might be a big whoop, but no, it's a big deal. And that's one reason why I don't think the Grammys are going to be very high rated, because people just aren't buying music anymore.
Our next story is about Ticketmaster, sort of. According to the Wall Street Journal, one of the nation's biggest concert and sports promoters said it is joining forces with a startup technology company to sell tickets to events at 105 arenas and theaters in what could become a broader battle with Live Nation Entertainment's Ticketmaster. The promoter, Anschultz Entertainment Group, had been expected to distance itself from Ticketmaster since early last year when the Justice Department approved the ticketing giant's merger with Live Nation, AEG's only larger rival in concert promotion. Now, in approving that merger, antitrust regulators required that AEG be allowed to compete with Ticketmaster for ticket sales. And as part of that requirement, I haven't hit the punchline yet. So they're using this software, right? But the Ticketmaster, but AEG has said, you know what? We don't want to use it. We're going to do this joint venture with Outbox Enterprises, and its partners include Outbox Technology. Well, guess who runs Outbox Technology?
Who?
Frederick Rosen, a former Ticketmaster chief executive who piloted that company to dominance in the 1980s and 1990s. He was the guy who put Ticketmaster on top, Fred Rosen. And now he's teaming up with AEG to work on similar technology for them.
Well, good. It's a big deal. You definitely want a serious competitor to Ticketmaster because it's healthier for the business and healthier for everyone overall.
Yes, I would agree. I think that the only reason it's a big deal is because it happens to be somebody who really, he can do it again. Let's put it that way.
Cool.
The Weinstein Company humbly and modestly confirmed a UK newspaper report that Queen Elizabeth, the daughter of King Edward, who is depicted in the Oscar hopeful The King's Speech, was deeply moved by the film. That means Harvey Weinstein and director Tom Hooper got to release statements that they were deeply moved by Queen Elizabeth being deeply moved and hoped that would shut up the people who wanted to diss the film as Oscar night approaches. Isn't that amazing that the Queen's reaction should leak just now? And is it a big deal, Michael, or a big whoop?
It's a big PR ploy. I don't buy it at all. She's not going to go out and deny that she saw the movie. I mean, I guess she probably saw it, but it's just all malarkey. It's just part of the Oscar campaign. It reminds me of when the Pope gave a good review to the Passion of the Christ. It's just, you know, it's crazy.
Well, now our next story, Michael, I was actually in Ireland watching Top Gear, which is a show about cars, a very popular show on BBC about cars, when I heard this exchange.
Chaps, listen, have you ever wanted a Mexican sports car?
Yes, I have.
Well, it's good news because there is one, and here it is, and it's called the Tortilla.
It is not called the Tortilla. What is it called?
I can't remember. It's something a bit...
So you just made up the name of
the
Tortilla?
Yes, I did. I've forgotten.
Why would you want a Mexican car? Because cars reflect national characteristics, don't they? So German cars are sort of very well built and efficient. Yeah. Italian cars are a bit flamboyant and quick. Mexican cars just going to be a lazy, feckless, flatulent over the stops. Leaning against a fence asleep, looking at a cactus with a blanket with a hole in the middle on as a coat.
it's interesting because they can't do food, the Mexicans, can they? Because it's all like sick with cheese on it. I mean,
refried sick.
Yeah, refried sick.
I'm sorry, but just imagine waking up and remembering you're Mexican.
That'd be brilliant. It'd be brilliant because you could just go straight back to sleep again. Oh, I'm a Mexican. I'm going to Mexico.
All I'm going to do all day.
That's why we're not going to get any complaints about this, because the Mexican embassy, the ambassador's going to be sitting there with a remote control like this. I'm in Mexico. They won't complain. It's fine.
Okay, so the BBC did get complaints from the Mexican ambassador, and they aren't backing down. They're saying, hey, you know what? That's a part of British humor, you know, making fun of stereotypes. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
They're not making fun of stereotypes. They're perpetuating stereotypes.
Yes.
That's not cheeky British humor. That's not, we always make fun of other nations and people. That's ridiculous.
They said
it's a very big show. It's a very popular show. But the idea that, like, you watch them to have them mock Poles and Jews and Mexicans is ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because as I was watching, I thought, I don't think that you could get away with this in the United States.
Yeah, you shouldn't get away with it in England. I mean, not that they shouldn't get away with it, but the sense that you should expect people to be upset and angry with you, it's obnoxious and stupid.
Right. And they said, when we do it, we are being rude. Yes. And mischievous. But there is no
mischievous. Isn't that so cute?
Yes. But there is no vindictiveness behind the comments.
Good Lord. That's bizarre that the BBC doesn't even, that's kind of interesting that they don't even feel the need to back off of it.
Nope, they don't. Our next story is about Melissa Leo, the Best Supporting Actress frontrunner, personally paid for a Hollywood trade ad, including one on Deadline.com and The Hollywood Reporter. Now, this ad shows her super glammed up wearing quote-unquote faux, not real fur, and a glittery evening gown. The text simply said, consider. And below that, Melissa Leo. and in very tiny fine print off to the side, a web address, melissaleo.com, a photo credit, and a fur photo credit. There is no reference to her movie, The Fighter, or her critically acclaimed and gritty real-life character, Alice Ward, and this is coming from Deadline.com. So, Michael, is Melissa Leo going rogue with her own personal campaign ads a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in this in the world of the Oscars. I know other people have done it before. I don't understand why she didn't promote the movie more. I mean, if you're going to do an Oscar ad campaign, why not help it sell your movie, unless she thought of it as just a chance to promote herself and her career? It just seems like not a very smart ad.
No, I mean, they're saying that it could cost her this Oscar.
Well, only because it's dumbly done. If it had just been a thing saying, you know, The Fighter, Melissa Leo, please, for your consideration, nobody would have noticed. It would just been another chance to try and promote the film and her role in it and hopefully win the Oscar. But because she made herself the focus instead of the film and her performance, she messed up. That reminds me of The Color Purple. Very famously, one of the actors in the movie, Margaret Avery, took out her own ad in the trades, and she wrote it in this faux rustic, illiterate style, saying, "I sure am glad you done give me the Oscar nomination. I sure hopes you be thinking of me come Oscar day." I mean, I'm not exaggerating. People were scandalized, and that not only did that ruin her chances of winning the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, but it ruined her chances of a career.
Yeah, she's never, I mean, she has not worked all that consistently since.
Yeah, so I don't think this will have that disastrous effect on Melissa Leo, but you know, yeah, you think you want more ads for your movie? Sure, go right ahead. Why not take out an ad? You know, it can only help. But why bring attention to the fact that you're doing it and the fact that it's not really about the movie, but you?
Jon Stewart and The Daily Show are back on Hulu, nearly a year after Viacom pulled its shows from the free web-based service that streams popular TV shows the day after they air. It has come to a deal with Hulu, and Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who is on The Colbert Report and is the host of The Colbert Report, will be back on the service. A big reason? Hulu Plus, which charges a monthly fee and offers programming available 3 weeks after they air. Viacom is going to include The Jersey Shore, Hot in Cleveland, and many others, with monthly fees for Netflix and Hulu, and a similar service for video games called OnLive. Is there any doubt that music will be soon? And is Viacom's return to Hulu a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal in the short term. I mean, we still don't know if Hulu's going to be around 5 years from now. My guess would be no, for a lot of reasons, but yeah, it's a big deal. They paid like $40 million. It was a $40 million deal to get them back in there in the mix. And it's obviously one of the most popular offerings. So it matters a lot for the short-term viability of Hulu. I think it helps tremendously.
Star Wars merchandise had its best year ever for a year in which no feature film was actually released. The venerable toy franchise and the source of George Lucas's unending wealth grossed $510 million in 2010. Thanks to an ever-expanding line of product and creative spin-offs like the TV series Clone Wars to keep the franchise active. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's kind of amazing. $500 million in a non-movie year. I mean, it's been years since a new movie was released. Boy, that was the best single contract thing ever done in a movie when he traded some things for toy rights to Star Wars.
All that licensing.
Yeah.
I'll never forget, I actually interviewed Mark Hamill once, and I'm sure he's said this story a bunch of times, but really quickly, the first film comes out, he has a kid, and the kid wants, you know, one of the Star Wars toys, you know, of his father. So he calls Lucasfilm and says, "Look, just send one of everything over. You know, I don't know which one I want, just send one." The next day, a huge truck arrives and delivers like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of toys. He had no idea that there were that many toys.
That's hilarious. I never heard that.
Keith Olbermann has announced his next step. He's switching from MSNBC to Current TV, the Al Gore-backed cable channel that is barely a blip on the ratings dial. It averages 23,000 viewers in prime time. He joins in the spring and gets an equity stake in the company. Potentially an equity stake. We'll see about that. An executive producer role on his one-hour show and the title of chief news officer. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, with all the options that he must have had on the table, it's a big gamble, that's for sure.
That is true, yeah.
Why you would want to go there, I can't even imagine. Maybe he thinks, hey, I helped build up MSNBC, I can do the same with Current TV, but this cable channel basically doesn't even exist. There are a lot of better, different options. I think building up MSNBC was a huge accomplishment. Doing Current TV, I can't imagine it happening. I had to look to see if I had it on my cable service. I do, it's channel 103 in New York. On Time Warner Cable, but golly.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. Now, last week, Michael, you deluged us with info about the changing book publishing industry. In a reflection of these fast-moving times, the New York Times unveiled a new bestseller list. They include a list for print books, which I guess they've always done, a list for ebooks, which they started recently, and a combined list that includes all sales in one spot. Naturally, a shakeup like this includes some surprises, like Harlequin romance novels hitting the fiction list for the first time in a long while. Plus, the New York Times reports that ebook sales of novels for teens and kids are exploding as e-readers become more and more common among young people. What do you think, Michael?
Well, this ebook list is a stopgap measure, and the idea of saying, here's the print edition and here are the ebook editions, and oh, hey, let's combine these into one, you know, one title. This is going to be gone in a year or two, and you'll just have one bestseller list. You know, it would be like breaking out digital sales from album sales. There's no reason to do it anymore. Once the ebooks take over, and they're going to do it very rapidly, the idea of breaking them down into each, who cares whether someone buys a book physically or ebook wise or whatever, you know, it's just not an important distinction. So this is something that reflects the changing times and it will soon become subsumed and disappear. And you'll just have the New York Times bestseller list again, and it will reflect whatever way you buy a book. I think it should even reflect whether you buy a book on audio, you know?
Well, I would agree with that.
You know, if you buy the new Tom Clancy book, whether it's print or ebook or audio, that's a sale.
Well, they certainly won't have to be calling Borders for too much longer, it seems, to get any of those sales figures.
That's true. The Borders is really reeling. They're really having a terrible time. They've just been delisted on the New York Stock Exchange because they don't meet certain criteria for companies that need to be traded on the board. Their stock is below a dollar or below 60 cents, I think. It can still be traded. You can still trade your Borders stocks, and they could get back on the list in 6 months if they meet a series of goals. But of course, they may not even be around by then. So Borders is really, gosh, I don't know if they're going to be able to do a chapter Chapter 11 is where they reorganize, and Chapter 7 is where they liquidate, right?
Correct, I believe so. And of course, we'll probably be corrected next week by some of our listener email, which we're going to move on to here in a moment.
Yeah, so the only thing I would say about the books is, you know, the whole world is changing. It's very interesting to see the teens starting to get e-readers. The New York Times caught on to this because they suddenly saw that young adult novels were hitting the e-book bestseller list. And they said, what's going on? Some of it, of course, is crossover from adults reading books like Harry Potter or whatever it might be. But a lot of it is parents buying a new e-reader and giving their kids their old one, or buying one for their kids outright. They can take them to camp. They can take it here. They can take it there. Parents said, hey, anything to make their kids read is good by them. And that kids were reading a lot and getting excited by it. And so hopefully it's a good trend for reading.
Well, we're going to move on to listener email. And we have an email here from a listener in Virginia. Michael, do you want to read it for us?
Sure, it's from Ed Bogosian of Alexandria, Virginia. He says, hey kids, I'm pretty sure you didn't miss Chris Lee's post in the LA Times, since they seem to be your favorite newspaper. But just in case, I wanted to call your attention to it. In the post, Lee expanded on a Times feature about the popular music group Antron Legacy composers Daft Punk. Apparently, the duo behind the popular music group is a big fan of MGMT. Here's the excerpt. Quote, pressed on what they're listening to, though, the Homum Christo and Bangaltar of Daft Punk reluctantly divulged what's been in heavy rotation at the Daft Arts Complex in Hollywood, the sophomore album from psychedelic rockers MGMT that sharply divided critics last year. I really like the MGMT album, congratulations, said Bangaltar. That's probably my favorite album this year. Yeah, the Homum Christo said, nodding. That's really good. And Ed Bogosian continues, love the show, keep it up. And thanks a lot, Ed, for writing in and sharing. Anything good news about MGMT, we're always happy to share.
If you want to write to us, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You never know, we might play your voicemail on the air. Now, all of that information, along with all of our social networking accounts, like, I don't know, Facebook and Twitter, as well as ways to subscribe to the show. You can subscribe in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, your RSS reader, via email. All of that can be found on showbizsandbox.com. That's our website. That is also where you will find links to all of the stories we've discussed in today's episode. And, of course, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, which is also his Twitter username, Michael Giltz. My Twitter username is Sperling, so at Sperling, and you can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.